Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 435, being recorded on November 17th of 2003. The title of the program is Road to Lugano. Before I get into the main substance of the broadcast, sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. Within a week or so, sometimes 2 weeks, of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed, annotated description of For the Record program number 435 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. So if people find this admittedly very pedantic form of broadcasting, kind of tough to assimilate, in addition to the WFMU Real Audio Archives, the For the Record section of the Spitfire website will have a long annotated description so you can read all about it. Please be aware that the Spitfire website is equipped with Real Audio as well, and the most recently recorded pair of half-hour segments is available on the Spitfire website for about a week or so after the recording of the program. Now, the title of the broadcast is The Road to Lugano. Perhaps that should be plural, roads to Lugano. Lugano in Switzerland is a major international money-changing center. It is the epicenter of a number of different international financial networks. And the two that we're going to be looking at in the course of the broadcast today are the Thyssen-Bornemisza Industrial Concern. It has been based primarily in Lugano, Switzerland, since after World War I. It is the Thyssen-Bornemisza Concern, which in turn is the central element in the Thyssen Heavy Industrial Complex that now is called ThyssenKrupp because it is merged with the famous Krupp armaments maker of Germany. It is the largest heavy industrial concern in Western Europe. As veteran listeners to this program know, and as annotated in among other programs, FTRs 305 and 370, the Thyssen-Bornemisza complex is also the foundation of a good deal of the Bush family's economic largesse. And we're going to be taking a look not only at some information which reviews some of the Bush-Nazi industrial dealings, but most significantly for our purposes, the article we're about to look at discusses newly released or newly discovered U.S. government documents that document the pattern of Bush/Harriman family dealings with the Thyssen industrial complex well after the end of World War II, and perhaps for our purposes most significantly document the ongoing dealings between the Bush family or members thereof and the Harriman complex and the Thyssen concern after World War II and aiding in the flight of capital to neutral countries. As veteran listeners to this program know, this concretely and from U.S. government documents links the Bush family with the Aktion Adlerflug or Bormann Flight Capital Organization that Operation Safe Haven was aimed at interdicting. We're going to be taking a look at that later on in the program. We're going to be taking a look at the Alpaqua organization. That is the epicenter of the Muslim Brotherhood. That is an Islamic fascist organization which has adopted fundamentalist religious trappings. That organization, too, dates to the period between the World Wars. It also has very strong links with the Third Reich in its above ground and below ground forms. And what we're going to be taking a look at as well is the frustration of Operation Green Quest. So we're going to be taking a look at the road or roads to Lugano. We're going to be taking a look at the Thyssen-Bornemisza firm. We're going to be taking a look at Bank Altaqua. We're going to be taking a look at the role of Thyssen-Bornemisza and the Bush family in interdicting or frustrating Operation Safe Haven, the U.S. Treasury and U.S. Intelligence Department operation aimed at interdicting the Nazi flight capital program. And we're going to take a look at Bank Altaqua and the frustration of Operation Green Quest, the 2002 operation, also centered on the U.S. Treasury Department, that aims at interdicting the flow of monies to Al-Qaeda as well as Hamas. Common elements in these are the Third Reich, Lugano, Switzerland, and, as we're going to see, elements of the Bush family and the Republican administration. On the investigative and pro side, we're going to be taking a look at the heroic John Loftus, former Justice Department investigator, who has been at the core of the investigation into the post-war Bush money deal, the Bush family Nazi money dealings. He also has been at the core of the Operation Green Quest raids. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that I was informed about this from a member of the listening audience. This is from the New Hampshire Gazette of November 7th of 2003. The New Hampshire Gazette is the oldest continuously publishing newspaper in the United States. It was founded in 1756 by D. Fowle, or Fowle, F-O-W-L-E. That actually predates the U.S. itself by 20 years, and it is still publishing. You can visit their website at nhgazette.com, www.nhgazette.com. This article is from the New Hampshire Gazette of November 7th of 2003. It's volume 248, number 3. The article is by John Buchanan and Stacy Michael of the New Hampshire Gazette. It's titled, Bush Nazi Dealings Continued Until 1951, Federal Documents. A fair amount of the information in this article will be by way of review for veteran listeners, but note in particular the U.S. government documents that confirm the findings by Paul Manning, also using government documents in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, that in fact the Bush family Nazi dealings continued into the post-war period and aided in the flight of Nazi capital. Again, common elements here, the Bush family through the ages, the Republican administration currently in power, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Third Reich, and with the Thyssen-Bornemisza and Al-Taqwa connections, Lugano, Switzerland. Hence the title, The Road to Lugano. The article from the New Hampshire Gazette of 11/7/2003 reads, after the seizures in late 1942 of five U.S. enterprises he managed on behalf of the Nazi industrialist Fritz Thyssen, Prescott Bush, the grandfather of President George W. Bush, failed to divest himself of more than a dozen enemy-national relationships that continued until as late as 1951, newly discovered U.S. government documents reveal. Furthermore, the records show that Bush and his colleagues routinely attempted to conceal their activities from government investigators. Bush's partners in the secret web of Thyssen-controlled ventures included former New York Governor W. Averill Harriman and his younger brother E. Roland Harriman. Their quarter century of Nazi financial transactions from 1924 to 1951 were conducted by the New York private banking firm Brown Brothers Harriman. The White House did not return phone calls seeking comment. Although the additional seizures under the Trading with the Enemy Act did not take place until after the war, documents from the National Archives and Library of Congress confirm that Bush and his partners continued their Nazi dealings unabated. These activities included a financial relationship with the German city of Hanover and several industrial concerns. They went undetected by investigators until after World War II. At the same time Bush and the Harrimans were profiting from their Nazi partnerships, W. Averill Harriman was serving as President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's personal emissary to the United Kingdom during the toughest years of World War II. On October 28, 1942, the same day two key Bush-Harriman-run businesses were being seized by the U.S. government, Harriman was meeting in London with Field Marshal Smuts to discuss the war effort. While Harriman was concealing his Nazi relationships from his government colleagues, Cornelius Levence, L-I-V-E-N-S-E, the top executive of the interlocking German concerns held under the corporate umbrella of Union Banking Corporation, or UBC, repeatedly tried to mislead investigators and was sometimes supported in his subterfuge by Brown Brothers Harriman. All of the assets of UBC and its related businesses belong to Thiessen-controlled enterprises, including his bank for Hondelen Scheepvaart in Rotterdam, the documents state. Nevertheless, Levents, president of UBC, claimed to have no knowledge of such a relationship. Quote, strangely enough, Levents claims he does not know the actual ownership of the company, states a government report. H.D. Pennington, manager of Brown Brothers Harriman and a director of UBC for many years, unquote, also lied to investigators about the secret and well-concealed relationship with Thiessen's Dutch bank, according to the documents. Investigators later reported that the company was, quote, wholly owned, unquote, by Thiessen's Dutch bank. Despite such ongoing subterfuge, U.S. investigators were able to show that, quote, a careful examination of UBC's general ledger, cash books, and journals from 1919 until the present date clearly established that the principal and practically only source of funds has been Bank voor Hondelen Scheepvaart. In yet another attempt to mislead investigators, Levents said that $240,000 in banknotes in a safe deposit box at Underwriters Trust Company in New York had been given to him by another UBC Thiessen associate, H.J. Kevenhoven, managing director of Thiessen's Dutch Bank and a director of the August Thiessen Bank in Berlin. August Thiessen was Fritz's father. The government report shows that Levents first neglected to report the $240,000, then claimed that it had been given to him as a gift by Kevenhoven. However, by the time Levents filed a financial disclosure with U.S. officials, he changed his story again and reported the sum as a debt rather than a cash holding. In yet another attempt to deceive the governments of both the U.S. and Canada, Levents and his partners misreported the facts about the sale of a Canadian front enterprise, La Coopérative Catholique des Consommateurs de Combustible, which imported German coal into Canada via the web of Thiessen-controlled U.S. businesses. Quote, the Canadian authorities, however, were not taken in by this maneuver, a U.S. government report states. The coal company was later seized by Canadian authorities. This next couple of paragraphs is the single most important element of this particular very important article. And note that this documents from U.S. government documents, again, the perpetuation of the Bush-Harriman Thiessen family dealings into the post-war period and shows the participation of Bush-Harriman firms in the Nazi flight capital program. That, obviously, to veteran listeners, signifies Bormann. The article continues. After the war, a total of 18 additional Brown Brothers Harriman and UBC-related client assets were seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act, including several that showed the continuation of a relationship with the Thiessen family after the initial 1942 seizures. The records also show that Bush and the Harrimans conducted business after the war with related concerns doing business in or moving assets into Switzerland, Panama, Argentina, and Brazil, all critical outposts for the flight of Nazi capital after Germany's surrender in 1945. This last sentence again. The records also show that Bush and the Harrimans conducted business after the war with related concerns doing business in or moving assets into Switzerland, Panama, Argentina, and Brazil, all critical outposts for the flight of Nazi capital after Germany's surrender in 1945. Fritz Thiessen died in Argentina in 1951. One of the final seizures in October 1950 concerned the U.S. assets of a Nazi baroness named Theresia Maria Ida Benedicta Huberta Stanislava Martina von Schwarzenberg, who also used two shorter aliases. Brown Brothers Harriman, where Prescott Bush and the Harrimans were partners, attempted to convince government investigators that the baroness had been a victim of Nazi persecution and therefore should be allowed to maintain her assets. It appears, rather, that the subject was a member of the Nazi Party, government investigators concluded. At the same time the last Brown Brothers Harriman client assets were seized, Prescott Bush announced his Senate campaign that led to his election in 1952. In 1943, 6 months after the seizure of UBC and its related companies, a government investigator noted in a Treasury Department memo dated April 8, 1943, that the FBI had inquired about the status of any investigation into the Bush and the Harrimans. Quote, "I gave a memorandum which did not say anything about the American officers of subject," the investigator wrote. "Another investigator wanted to know whether any specific action had been taken by us with respect to them," unquote. No further action beyond the initial seizures was ever taken, and the newly confirmed records went unseen by the American people for 6 decades. So why are the documents relevant today? Quote, "The story of Prescott Bush and Brown Brothers Harriman is an introduction to the real history of our country," says L.A. art book publisher and historian Edward Boswell. Quote, "It exposes the money-making motives behind our foreign policies dating back a full century. The ability of Prescott Bush and the Harrimans to bury their checkered pasts also reveals a collusion between Wall Street and the media that exists to this day." Sheldon Drobny, a Chicago entrepreneur and philanthropist who will soon launch a liberal talk radio network, says the importance of the new documents is that they prove a long pattern of Bush family war profiteering that continues today via George H.W. Bush's intimate relationship with the Saudi royal family and the Bin Ladens, conducted via the super-secret Carlyle Group, whose senior advisors include former U.S. Secretary of State James A. Baker III. In the post-9/11 world, Drobny finds the Bush-Saudi connection deeply troubling. Quote, "Trading with the enemy is trading with the enemy," he says. "That's the relevance of the documents and what they show," unquote. Lawrence Lader, an abortion rights activist and the author of more than 40 books, says, quote, "The relevance lies with the fact that the sitting president of the United States would lead the nation to war based on lies and against the wishes of the rest of the world," unquote. Lader and others draw comparison between President Bush's invasion of Iraq and Hitler's occupation of Poland in 1939, the event that sparked World War II. However, others see an even larger significance. Quote, "The discovery of the Bush-Nazi documents raises new questions about the role of Prescott Bush and his influential business partners in the secret emigration of Nazi war criminals, which allowed them to escape justice in Germany," says Bob Furtick, co-founder of Democrats.com and an amateur Nazi hunter. It also raises questions about the importance of Nazi recruits to the CIA in its early years in what was called Operation Paperclip and Prescott Bush's role in that dark operation, unquote. Furtick and others, including former Justice Department Nazi war crimes prosecutor John Loftus, a constitutional attorney in Miami, and a former Veterans Administration official, believe Prescott Bush and the Harrimans should have been tried for treason. Now, say Furtick and Loftus, there should be a congressional investigation into the Bush family's Nazi past and its concealment from the American people for 60 years. Quote, "The American people have a right to know in detail about this hidden chapter of our history," says Loftus, author of The Secret War Against the Jews. Quote, "That's the only way we can understand it and deal with it," unquote. For his part, Furtick is pessimistic that even a congressional investigation can thwart the war profiteering of the present Bush White House. "It's impossible to stop it," he says, "when the worst war profiteers are George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, who operate in secrecy behind the vast powers of the White House." And then the article then notes that John Buchanan is a journalist and magazine writer based in Miami Beach. Stacey Michael, the co-author, is a New Orleans-based journalist and author of Religious Conceit. He's also writing a book called Weapons of Mass Dysfunction, The Art of Faith-Based Politics. That article, again, from the New Hampshire Gazette of November 7th of 2003. And I'm also going to read, before I comment on that, and I think that is a remarkable article, and again, note the dealings, the Bush, Harriman, and Bush family dealings with the Thiessen family in the post-war Nazi flight capital program. Before I comment on that and before we move on to some other signposts on the road to Lugano, I'm going to read an interview also from the New Hampshire Gazette, this from October 24th of 2003. It's an interview with John Loftus by John Buchanan. Buchanan, what do you think is the true significance of the story in the New Hampshire Gazette? Loftus. Your story, the first in a reputable U.S. newspaper in 60 years, redeemed my two decades of work that only resulted in the mainstream media slamming doors in my face, despite my credentials as a Justice Department Nazi war crimes prosecutor. I give a lot of credit to the courage of the New Hampshire Gazette as well for practicing journalism as it should be practiced, tell the truth, and let the facts speak for themselves. Buchanan. How do you explain the fact that the mainstream media has simply refused to touch it? Loftus. It's a complex story, and the media hate that now in the age of the soundbite headline. It's also unpopular and frightening to most people, understandably. But the truth about this period of our history as a nation must come out and be dealt with. You and the Gazette have helped to accomplish that. It will come out now, I think. Buchanan, what's the importance of it coming out in your view? Loftus, your stories will be the crack in the dam and it will come flooding out. For 60 years, it has been a huge cover-up of the activities of some of the people who brought us the worst grief in the history of the world, the Holocaust. This country needs to understand which of its most prominent families supported Hitler, even after the U.S. went to war with Germany. Buchanan, can you offer a good example? Loftus, Joseph Kennedy brought his Nazi stocks from Prescott Bush. The British thought Kennedy was guilty of treason because his code clerk was tried in London as a Nazi agent and convicted. Buchanan, how do you account for the failure of the media to break this story before the Gazette did? Loftus, my feeling is that about 15 years ago, when big corporations started taking over media companies that had been privately owned by families or individuals, we ended up with an overworked but well-intentioned media without the staff or resources in light of all the corporate cost-cutting that was done to look into the really big stories. The real enemy is the multinational corporations who are only interested in profits and choose profits over truth. Buchanan. What can be done about that? Loftus. We need to educate the media. Buchanan. Should Prescott Bush, George Herbert Walker and the Harrimans have been tried for treason? Loftus, yes, they should have been tried for treason because they continued to support Hitler after the U.S. entered the war. As a former prosecutor, I could have made that case. Buchanan, what do you think their true motives were in betraying their country for profit? Loftus, it was a perfect example of spin before the term was ever invented. Their goal was that no matter which side won the war, their international industrial cartel would survive and prosper. They had a perfect setup, a bank in New York, UBC, one in Holland, Bank for Handel and Schifffahrt, and one in Germany, August Thiessen Bank. They were prepared for anything that could have happened. They wanted to avoid exactly what happened to Fritz Thiessen after World War I. That was the whole point. He had lost many of his major businesses, and they came up with a better way to prepare for the Second World War. Buchanan. This, by the way, is John Buchanan, no relation to Pat Buchanan, the notorious right-wing pundit and former press coordinator for the Reagan White House. Beginning again, Buchanan, did they manage the cover-up after the first seizures in 1942 and continue with their dealings until 1951, when Thiessen died in Argentina? Loftus. They brought in John Foster Dulles and Ad Sullivan and Cromwell and his brother Alan in Europe. The Dulles brothers put into effect a cloaking arrangement that was reflected in the records of Brown Brothers Harriman. There was one account, Brown Brothers Schroeder Rock, that was a cloaking account at Schroeder Bank. The Rock was the Rockefellers. Buchanan, what were they most guilty of after the U.S. entered the war? Loftus. They shipped gold through Axis countries after the U.S. entered the war. That certainly was treason because it gave aid and comfort to the enemy and assisted them economically. Buchanan, why would they do that, take that chance of facing execution for treason if caught? Loftus, they were afraid Britain would lose the war and they were protecting themselves. Buchanan, if there is information like that to be uncovered still, what do you propose? Loftus, I want a full congressional investigation and I think your reporting in the Gazette certainly justifies one. I want the cover-up itself investigated, and I want the long-concealed Nazi histories of these families brought out to the public. Buchanan, who should investigate? Loftus, now that this information has finally come out, I am calling for full investigations by both the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. We'll see where it goes from there, but I want the cover-up fully and aggressively investigated. The American people and Congress have a right to find out how this happened to make sure it never happens again. It's too late for justice, but it's never too late for the truth. The American people and survivors of the Holocaust and veterans of the war are entitled to the truth. Buchanan, why hasn't it come out before? Loftus, President Clinton wanted all the Nazi files declassified, but it didn't happen fast enough. Some of the documents you saw on I.G. Farben were only declassified a few days before you walked into the archives. You were very lucky, I'd say. And that again from the New Hampshire Gazette of October 24th of 2003. The cover-up of the Bush-Thiessen-Nazi money connection has caused some casualties. I'm going to review a couple of items from FTR 370, this in turn from an article on John Loftus's website, How the Bush Family Made Its Fortune from the Nazis. And this concerns the untimely demise of the manager of the Dutch Bank that was part of this financial triangle. Quote, in 1945, the former Dutch manager of the Rotterdam Bank resumed control only to discover that he was sitting on a huge pile of hidden Nazi assets. In 1947, the manager threatened to inform Dutch authorities and was immediately fired by the Thiessens. The somewhat naive bank manager then fled to New York City, where he intended to talk to Union Bank director Prescott Bush. As Gowan's Dutch source recalled, the manager intended to reveal to Prescott Bush the truth about Baron Heinrich, that's Baron Heinrich Thiessen-Bornemisza, and the Rotterdam Bank, in order that some or all of the Thiessen interests in the Thiessen Group might be seized and confiscated as German enemy property. The manager's body was found in New York 2 weeks later. And by the way, skipping down, this same pattern of mortality continued up to just a few years ago. Quote, similarly, in 1996, a Dutch journalist Eddie Rover went to London to interview the Baron, who is neighbors with Margaret Thatcher. Rover's body was discovered 2 days later. Perhaps, Gowan remarked dryly, it was only a coincidence that both healthy men had died of heart attacks immediately after trying to uncover the truth about the Thiessens, unquote. Neither Gowan nor his Dutch source knew about the corroborating evidence in the Alien Property Custodian archives or in the Omgus archives. Together, the two separate sets of U.S. files overlap each other and directly corroborate Gowan's source. The first set of archives confirms absolutely that the Union Banking Corporation in New York was owned by the Rotterdam Bank. The second set, quoted by Paul Manning in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, confirms that the Rotterdam Bank, in turn, was owned by the Thiessens. And by way of tying this connection up with Lugano, Switzerland, and we're going to go into that in part two, from, once again, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, quote, Heinrich Thiessen-Bornemisza runs his private Dutch-based investment group from Lugano, Switzerland, and his cousin, Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, grandson of old Fritz Thiessen, exercises control over Thiessen AG from his base in Buenos Aires. And so we will continue with the Lugano-Switzerland connection inside two of this program. WFMU archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. Recent programs that are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only at a longer URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. There'll be a written, annotated description of this program within a couple of weeks or so of the airing of this program. That'll be in the Spitfire section, the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. That concludes Side 1 of FTR 435, The Road to Lugano, being recorded on November 17, 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.